went to the Seven Commandments. And I said at one point that they really aren't seven, as you know, but they are, they're only seven headings. And I would just like to demonstrate to you exactly what that means, because, you know, I can make a statement, but, you know, when you learn Talmud, you got to prove your statement. You can't just ask people to rely on good faith. Now, I just want to clarify, just so you should get, I'm not going to go into how many there are, because this is not an exact toll, but just to give you an example, the sexual restrictions for the Ben Noach, so immediately there are six basic ones, okay? And there's the living with a mother, with the wife of the father, if not the mother, with another man's wife, with his sister from his mother, with a male or with an animal. So right away you have six. Now in the count of the Taryag of the 613, you see, in the 613 count for the Ben Israel, that would immediately be six. Okay? So you have six right there. Now, again, let's take the one on theft. Now, the one on theft involves, I haven't made a real count. That would be a study in itself. But I could tell you right away, it's upwards of 18. Right away. You have four right away, according to Nachmanides, for sure. You have the four types of damages, ways of damaging people, either physically with your money, with your something you own. That is, with a if you make a pit, for instance, that somebody falls into, that's already damages. You're obligated for that, even though you didn't do it. You know, you only caused the damage, but that's considered damage. There's four categories right there. You've got if a person would have a business where scales are not accurate, another one. There's upwards of 18 and up right away. Stealing, for instance, would involve also kidnapping, which is a separate commandment for the Ben Israel, in the system of the 613. So the sixth, right away, like I say, in each, and for instance, take for instance courts, the setting up courts, you'd have at least six or seven right there to set up courts and not to show any deference to a wealthy person or kindness to a person and have him win a case. You'd have it right there. So I didn't make an accurate count, as I said, but the I know some people claim 60 in the 60s, whatever it is. But the point I'm making is that when you say seven mitzvot, seven commandments, you do not mean commandments in the same sense that you mean in the 613 system. This is the point I'm trying to make, that the term commandments over here is not synonymous with the term commandments used in the 613. Over here, they are basically as you refer to them, as headings or themes. Okay, I would say themes. Now back to that concept in a moment. My question here is there anything like that for the Ben Israel? A concept like that for the Ben Israel? Maybe somebody has. If somebody has an answer, I'll take it. If not, I'll tell you what it is. The answer is yes, there is, and that is in the Ten Commandments. Okay, the Ten Commandments also are not really ten mitzvot. Over there, there are several that are idolatry. For instance, involves several of them, several commandments. So numerically, they are more than ten in terms of if you count them as commandments in the system of Tayag. They're called the Ten Words. Really, not the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments is a misnomer. Moses referred to them as the Dibros, Aseres HaDivorim, the Ten Words or themes. Okay, so therefore, you see, for the Ben Israel as well, there is a concept that sometimes we deal with themes, sometimes we deal with commandments as meaning, when I say commandments now, I mean commandments as they would be counted in the 613 system, okay? So you have two systems here. You have a system of commandments, per se, and then you have a system of themes. Now, the reason why you have, why it's called, as a matter of fact, Maimonides, who is the genius of precise definition, in his formulation, he doesn't say, when he starts off to talk about the seven commandments for the Ben Noah, he doesn't call it commandments at first. He says, on six things, Adam the first was commanded. He uses the word different things. Then, in the end, he says, it comes out that there are sheva mitzvot. What he's trying to tell you is that the term sheva mitzvot, seven commandments, which are used by the rabbis, by the Talmud, does not mean really commandments in the same sense as we count the 613 system. It's not the same sense. They're called that way because the word commandment means something that was commanded by God. So in that sense, they're commanded. They're commandments. But they're not commandments in the sense of the numerical, the method of numerical valuation that are given to the system, that are used in the system of the 613. Okay. Now, why is this so? I believe the reason is something that we've discussed, and that is that when we say the seven commandments, see, the seven commandments map out something. They map out the minimal lifestyle of a society that is worthy in God's eyes of existence. So it is the minimal level of societal righteousness. So it's mapping out over here a lifestyle. Now, when you're mapping out a lifestyle, so then the themes are the important thing, not the numerical valuation of breaking it down into how many commandments. The point here is to the lifestyle, it is the themes that are central in such a process. Whereas if you're trying to count how many commandments were given, then every time you have an arm, you have to count it as a different commandment. Now, we've mentioned last time when we studied the commandment and the process of studying the commandment of blasphemy. So we mentioned that why is it that the death penalty is given for in every case? And we said that the reason why is because it's not the violation per se that incurs the death penalty. It's the refusal to commit to this lifestyle, this minimal lifestyle that involves the forfeiture of a person's life. In other words, if a person says he's not going to commit to the seven, it means he's not committing to the basic lifestyle that God has established as the most rudimentary lifestyle for human societal existence. So it's not the particular action which is for which he's being punished. It's for the lack of commitment to that minimal lifestyle. So again, there we're speaking there, in such a case, we're speaking in terms of themes. The same thing is true of the Ten Commandments, because the Ten Commandments, when they were given as a means of creating a bris, a covenant between God and Israel, those commandments were used as a vehicle of creating the covenant. And if you're speaking of commandments in terms of a vehicle of a covenant, which is again a lifestyle, then it is the themes that are important and not counting up the particular forms of the commandments. So you have it in the Bible, you have it in two cases. You have it in the case of the Ten Commandments, and you have it in the case of the seven laws of Noah. Okay? The way we count depends upon what we are. If we are speaking about mapping out a specific lifestyle or creating an entity of a covenant, then it is the themes that are important. But if we're speaking about counting up how many specific forms of commandments there are, then we use the method of the 613, where each one counts as a separate, each one is a separate form, has a separate form, its own structure, its own halachic structure, and its own identity. So that's the first point I had wished to make. Okay, to prove, there is a very interesting statement in the Talmud, and it's in the Tractate of Chulin, and it is an obscure statement. The commentaries, Rashi for one, admits that he just doesn't understand he doesn't know the source of the statement. You know, our scholars are very honest. If they don't know the source, they don't know the source. But the statement of Talmud is nevertheless interesting. And I'll tell you what it is. It's a strange statement. It's in the Tractate of Chulin, and it's in 92. 92A goes over to 92B. Okay. So it says like this. It says that... it says that there were 30 30 commandments that the B'nai Noah accepted upon themselves. So Rashi, the great commentator Rashi, says, I don't know exactly what these 30 are and how that breakdown of 30 takes place. Okay, but obviously from the Talmud you see that it's more than 7. My method would be, the method that I was using was to simply take the heading and then go back to the 613 and see how, under each heading, how many there would be. Like I mentioned, the stealing, there would be at least 18. But it will come out to more than 30, so that system won't work. Obviously, Rashi thought of that system and saw that system will not work. So what exactly is meant by 30 is obscure. We just don't know what it means. The statement that Talmud continues, and it says that practically speaking, the world at large has only kept 3. And it's a strange piece of Talmud. I mean, I don't mind telling you, repeating to you, a strange piece of Talmud. We learn a lot of things that we don't understand. We just, you know, you keep in the back of your mind, maybe one day we will understand it. But there's nothing wrong in our system of education with studying things we don't understand. Now, it's a strange piece of Talmud. Talmud says that what are the 3 that they did keep? Okay. One of them is, today it's a big issue, as a matter of fact. One of them is that even though they didn't keep the ban, remember, this is speaking about the world on the whole. It's not speaking about individuals, righteous individuals. It's speaking about general society. It says even though they didn't keep the ban against homosexuality, but they didn't live with men. Men and a male and a male did not live together in a manner like man and wife. In other words, they didn't write a contract. That's exactly what's going on today, by the way. That the homosexuals want to have recognition of marriage between the same sex as just as there is recognition of marriage. It should be a legal phenomenon. Just like you have a man and a wife is a legal institution. The homosexuals want that the homosexual relationship should also be valid and should be treated in the same manner, tax-wise, et cetera, in the eyes of the state. So it's funny, it's interesting that Talmud says that that never happened, at least up to the time of the Talmud, that far they never went, to recognize the lifestyle of, even though they violated the prohibition against homosexuality, but they never considered it as, they didn't write a contract between homosexual and homosexual relations. They never wrote a contract and recognized it as a valid legal marriage. Okay? It's amazing that that is really that is the issue today. But this is what this is one thing that Thomas says that was that society at large kept, and another one, a semi cryptic. We don't what Rashi explains. It says that they avoided cannibalism. Okay, they avoided cannibalism, and there again, there is no. Again, that's a problem because, as I mentioned before, cannibalism is certainly. To kill another person would be murder, but that's one of the seven. But you could have cannibalism without killing somebody. You could just eat a cadaver, and that really wouldn't involve one of the seven. So why does the Talmud? There again. If we understand the seven as mapping out a lifestyle, there is no question that cannibalism, as I mentioned before, that even though the Torah does not specifically outlaw cannibalism, it is in the 613, it would be a come under a minor violation, sort of. Not like, it wouldn't be the same kind of violation as murder. In the seven, we don't have it. It doesn't appear as cannibalism per se. It would appear as murder, but nevertheless, this piece of Talmud is in conformity with the fact that the seven are the mapping out of a minimal lifestyle, and the avoidance of cannibalism would be an indication of the fact that at least the society never stooped below. The level of the base level of human existence has never stooped to cannibalism. In other words, basically what Thomas is saying is that the world at large came out of the cannibalistic state. Okay, and then the third thing it mentioned is that they have a respect for the Torah. That in general there is a respect among the nations for the Torah. So it is a strange piece of Talmud. I mean, Rashi is perplexed by, and it is difficult. I mean, I don't really claim to be able to explain it, but it is an interesting piece of Talmud that it states that there were three things that were kept basically, and those three things are, as I mentioned before, not to recognize a homosexual relationship as a legitimate marriage, the avoidance of cannibalism. And a certain respect for Torah. There again, we're not speaking in terms of the seven commandments per se, because one of them is not to respect the Torah, even though that is obviously included in the framework, because the reason why the Ben Noach is supposed to keep his seven commandments is based on the fact that he accepts the Torah. But what we see over here is that there is a different system. This 30 system is a different kind of a system, which we don't know exactly what was meant by that system. But it is an interesting piece of Talmud. I wanted to bring it to your attention. I think that, even though we don't understand it, as I said before, it's something to keep in the back of your mind. Maybe, perhaps, as we continue to study, maybe we will be able to shed some light on that Talmudic statement. Now let's see. Let us progress a little further back with the Talmud that we were doing over here. By the way, that piece of Talmud is not, is sort of like a lot of times the Talmud is side comments. That's like a side comment. That's not really a piece of Talmud that is involved in the strict analysis of the seven laws of Noah. And in studying Talmud, I often mention it's not an easy science, because you have to know what is really an analysis of a system per se, and what is a side comment that is might be understood on a philosophical plane. You see, there are different levels of discussion in the Talmud. A scholar learns how to distinguish between the strict study of the science and then casual statements that are of philosophical. It's a different level of statement. It's a different kind of a statement. So let's get back to the strict study of the seven laws, which is found in the Tractate of Sanhedrin, and which we were working on previously. Now we're in the study of the seven. We left off with the various statements, arguments of the scholars and the analysis of the seven. Okay, and the question that we had was, how do you explain the Talmud in the very same breath states there are seven, and then it proceeds to add several more? And we'll see that there is a method of understanding what the Talmud means here. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to return to a position that we had studied previously, and that position is that sorcery or magic is one of the things that the Ben Noah is prohibited from. And this is Rabbi Josey. He says everything that's mentioned in the chapter on Suri, the Ben Noah must follow precisely. Okay, that's it's not simply idolatry, but even sorcery must be removed from the societal framework of all human beings. Now this is an argument. Not everybody agrees with him. Others maintain, again, everybody maintains that the avoidance of superstition and sorcery is definitely a perfection in man. But we're not speaking about that when we're speaking about the seven laws. The seven laws are speaking about the minimal level of human existence. And the question is, if you have a society that doesn't serve idols, not idolatrous, believes in one God, believes that the God is not physical, God is the source of all creation, fine. But they are superstitious. If a black cat walks across the trail, then they will think something terrible is going to happen. All right, is that a society that is in violation, doesn't deserve to exist, or no? It's not optimum, but it doesn't mean that the society is doomed. I mean, it doesn't mean that in God's eyes the society is not worthy of existence. This is the question that the Talmud is dealing with. And this is what the seven commandments are about. It's describing the most basic lifestyle, and the Talmud has a debate about this. It's something like, I mean, basically, you might say our society, where horoscopes are read, and people believe these kind of things. I mean, if you put on television, you'll see they'll tell you can call certain people or go to a seance where you be introduced to the dead, things like that. These are all the things the Torah prohibits. So the question is that kind of a society considered in God's eyes as being beneath the basic fundamental level of human existence or not? It's not the best society, but it can exist in God's eyes. That's the question. Okay, now Rabbi Josey attempts to prove his point. I mean, if he makes it, he has to back it up. And he backs it up very nicely. He backs it up with the text of the Bible, and that is from Deuteronomy 18. Okay? Now, in Deuteronomy 18, we find that and I went through, I believe we did go through, the breakdown of some of those things that are mentioned in Deuteronomy 18 and what exactly they are. But I'm going to get directly to his proof. His proof is as follows. In Deuteronomy 18, it states, 18:9, all right, that you will come to the land that the Lord your God has given you. You shall not learn to do as the abominations of these nations. All right. Now, what are these abominations? And then it proceeds to explain them. 10. It is passing the son and daughter through fire, which was one form of idolatry. And then it goes into the various different forms of idolatry, which we went through last time, seeking the dead, determining the future through mediums, and all these things that we're pretty much familiar with, okay? Maybe, perhaps at a later time, after we finish the seven commandments, we can, seven mitzvot, actually, seven themes, we can go into what these things are in specific, because they're very interesting. But let's not do that right now. Let's go ahead to verse 12. Verse 12 is the key from which Rabbi Josi uses, the key point that Rabbi Josi used to support his argument. And then it says like this. It says, because it is the abomination of God, whoever does these things. Whoever does these things is an abomination before God, those individuals. And because of these abominations, God your God is driving out these people from before you. Okay? Now, here's an interesting point. It's just, and God would not give the land of Canaan, the land of Israel, to the Jewish people if the people that were there before deserved to live there. That was their place. They were there first. So God would not, since God is just in all his ways, and he's just to every single nation, and if you study Deuteronomy, you'll see each one has their own. Esau has his inheritance, and we are not permitted to make changes over there. I mean, everyone has their rights. So therefore, what the Torah is telling us here is that if it weren't, and that's really what was stated to Abraham at the very outset, that his seed cannot inherit the land at this point because they hadn't reached a level of wickedness where they deserve to be the inhabitants deserve to be driven from the land. But at the time when the people of Israel were ready as a nation to move into the land of Israel, God said that at that point, the sins of the nations that were the inhabitants of that land had reached a point where they did not deserve to continue to exist as a society, and therefore they were driven from the land. Okay? That's exactly what the verse means. Verse 12. Because of these abominations, God is driving them out and giving you this land. All right? Now, and then the final verse, which is an important one, it says, you shall be whole, complete, with the Lord your God, which means to say that's the summation of everything before. That means to say that anyone that believes in any kind of magical forces, devils, other kind of existences, is not complete with God because he thinks there are other forces out there besides God. So that's a summation of the whole chapter. Now, what Rabbi Josi says is as follows. Rabbi Josi says that we have a principle, and this is a principle given to Sinai and how to interpret the Torah. And the principle is that there is no such thing as punishment without sin. Okay? Whenever the Bible indicates punishment, it must also, ipso facto, must indicate sin. Because the Bible is not a book of punishment, it's a book of perfection. And if there is a punishment, the purpose of the punishment is in order to remove an imperfection and to perfect society and to perfect the individual. Okay? That, in general, by the way, is our attitude towards punishment from God. We say that the Bible says in Deuteronomy that God chastises a person as a father chastises a child, which means to say that punishment is really if a person would know that he is suffering because God has given him a punishment, he would be in a very good state, because that would mean that he is important enough for God to relate to him and to